Yep.
Hey, Small
This
Band,
is
the Great Dad Talks and greatdad.com. And I'm here with an old friend today, Caleb Gardner. And this is going to be, hope you'll all indulge us. Well, this may be a little bit of a catching up session, but Caleb has a new book called No Point B. So I wanted to help him out with that and also talk about fatherhood. So welcome, Caleb.
Hey, thanks for having me. Good to see you.
Yeah, so we kind of started this whole, what I guess we like to think we kind of started a revolution and involved parenting and really trying to heighten the role of dads. Back when we were doing our websites and going to dad conferences, there weren't more than a handful of people really trying to promote dads. I mean, dads were becoming more active, but we kind of saw that trend. It's kind of interesting how it's changed over the course of 15 years.
Yeah, I was trying to remember where we met. Was it at the Modern Media Man?
It
Is
could
that
have
what it
been, yeah,
was?
that was one of the first
Oh my
ones.
God, that one kind of unfortunate event that we all trauma bonded over.
Yeah, right. But we all did bond around the idea that we had a fellowship among people who are interested in this in the subject
Yeah.
for one purpose or another. And I really get a feeling from what you did afterwards. I mean, when we met, you were working at a PR agency, and then you went on to do to eventually be Barack Obama's voice on Twitter. You were responsible for all of Barack Obama's tweets. And so I wonder, I'm really curious as how that influence your more involvement in social change rather than the straight PR side.
Yeah, I mean, I was always interested in history and kind of big social movements from, I mean, I was a history major in college. So part of the reason I got interested in digital strategy and communications in the first place was seeing the power dynamics between, you know, how technology was shifting communication in the landscape and how it was going to affect business, but also, you know, government and I mean, everything. And I really saw this coming back in, you know, when I was finishing up my MBA in like 2009, like that's what I was most interested in. It's like, how do I connect to this like history major at undergrad where I was looking at big social trends with business and how, and, you know, I'm in these marketing classes and they're telling me, you know, the product, price, place, promotion, you know, the big like P's
All
of
four
marketing
B's.
and immediate. And then I'm on Twitter, like having conversations with Scott Mahoney at the time at Ford. And I was just like, wait, hold on. Like there, you're telling me the world works one way, but it's clearly starting to work another. And I just found that really fascinating. And so leaned into that in my career. So as you said, I was at Edelman for a while doing it on the corporate side and really enjoying the work, honestly, like being a digital strategist, but got this amazing opportunity eventually to do that work. But for a guy from Chicago with a funny name during his second administration, really was just at the right place at the right time in terms of people who were at Edelman and then coming to the campaign and back. And it was just, you know, proximity to the Obama campaign when in Chicago was literally like across the street when I was at Edelman. So I met a ton of people on the campaign and, you know, got the opportunity to work for him through that.
Yeah, well, what a crazy opportunity. I remember when you were changing and how exciting it seemed because social media at the time was relatively
Yeah.
new, and I don't think anybody could have seen how it would come to affect how businesses operate and the effect of social causes can really move mountains. In your
Yeah.
book, No Point D, you talk about, you say that paradigm shifting book, you said transforming change into something we do, not for some vague, brighter future, but as a practice for making a better world right now. And I kind of, that resonated with me because I think there's been such a change. I mean, I grew up in the advertising and marketing world myself, and there was always a lip service to a lot of projects. And there were, you know, we spent $100,000 doing a campaign to show that we were kind of, you know, for this cause, whatever it was, usually a health cause or something, you know, that wasn't
Yeah,
polarized.
right.
And then now we're in this era where there's a lot more pressure and people do have a lot more control. How do you see that going forward? Because I think at the same time there's also a lot of cynicism about
Yeah.
why corporations do what they do.
Yeah, I mean, we're at an interesting spot for that conversation because I do think coming out of working for the president and coming out of working at Edelman in 2016, 2017, you know, think about the moment we were in. Trump was just elected. We were having this like very self-reflective moment as a country, whether or not, you know, voted for him or not. You definitely like had a self-reflective moment about where are we going? Like, what do we want out of our public life? What do we want out of our technology? There was a huge conversation about what is tech playing a positive or negative role in our lives, right? And I think out of that, the pendulum swung way into the realm of, oh, we need to hold our public leaders more accountable. We need to hold our businesses more accountable. We need to hold ourselves more accountable. for mostly good. I think there's some toxicity that got baked into that in terms of how we hold each other accountable in the public square. And, you know, we could have arguments about cancel culture and the goods and bads of that. But I think for most of my point of view, at least, is that mostly ended up being good. But I think that's been long enough that we're actually in this backlash moment a little bit, where we're we're course correcting and we're having a little bit of pushback against all of that more progressive leaning online space that happened in that era. And now we are back to a point of saying, okay, what do we actually want to invest in? Let's say, you know, a few years ago, George Floyd happened. We made a huge company statements about DEI and where we were going to make investments for the Black community specifically. A lot of those are being rolled back now. A lot of those are being saying, like, did we make sustainable change here? And if not, why are we putting our money to this? You know, there, a lot of DEI people are being fired. Like, we're in this point where I think we are trying to figure out, what do we want to be? What do we want to fight for? And how are we going to let a slowing economy, which we are also in a weird moment of, affect those decisions? So I'm still mostly bullish on it, but I definitely don't think, and I write about this in the book, like, I don't think it happens by accident. I don't think it happens without our involvement, right? Like, that's part of making change a practice for right now, is that we don't get a future that we're not willing to invest in right at this moment. It doesn't just happen without our involvement.
Yeah, I think that's really important, because I think a lot of people thought that we could just say we're all going to push for these causes and corporations were going to just immediately just change over, and then they would always be focused on those things that they said they were, you know, they were suddenly for. And that doesn't seem to be the case. It seems like, as you say, things are shifting back. When you say making changes for, how does that guess what you say about changing things for right now versus for the long term?
Yeah. I mean, it's about daily practice. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. If you've ever had like a daily meditation practice, for example, or followed a daily workout routine, or really anything that you are having to put in the discipline to think about, how are the decisions that I make today going to affect the long-term future of my health, of my mental health, my physical health? That's really what it comes down to, is there is so much changing, and there is so much that we, in the media, in the news cycle, in our everyday lives, it feels so overwhelming to think about the kinds of problems we are facing right now. It is really easy to become cynical, to your point, or it's really easy to just do nothing, to be like, to experience that decision fatigue and decision paralysis and just say, I'm not going to do anything. I'm just going to sit on my sofa, or I'm just going to like ride into the, you know, my job and coast, or quiet quit, or whatever you want to call it.
It's focus on your family, the things you can control.
Yeah. Which, you know, that's not a bad thing, but what we need is people who are able to do that and still push forward and engage in all the ways that we need them to engage on an individual level, on a corporate level, on a community level. And being able to balance that and not get cynical, being able to find the context for where you can make a difference and not get overwhelmed by all of the information that we have about the world right now, is really a daily practice. It is something that we show up and we do every day, because otherwise it just doesn't happen. Right. There's a great quote by Albert Camus, who said, I'm going to butcher this, but it's something like, change only happens in acts of daily fidelity. And I think that's what it comes down to.
Yeah, but it's an ongoing practice, not just a one-time thing. The book itself is for leaders. So I'm very curious, having been in corporate America, where I think a lot of people anthropomorphize the corporation and they think, why does that corporation do these evil things? Or how could that corporation be so dishonest or whatever, with the idea that, like, a corporation actually has a soul, and the corporation is there to make money, and it doesn't, it's like AI. I mean, it'll do whatever it can to increase the shareholder value, and that's all it cares about. So what is your advice for leaders who are in positions of power, who are growing into positions of power, who want to do the right thing, but sometimes, you know, are forced to at least consider doing the wrong thing?
Yeah, I mean, that's what the book was written for, that audience in mind, and not just on a like C-suite or executive level, but on an individual level, like seeing an individual contributor as a potential leader, or a, you know, someone who wants to lead their business into more good. I think that you put it exactly right, which is that, I think it was Derrida who had this great philosophical idea of a desiring machine. And yeah. that is really what I would put a corporation into a category of, really any business into a category, where you add a level of complexity and the machine wants what it wants. And what it wants is to produce and to make money. And it wants to, like, you know what I mean? Like, there's just, yeah. there's cogs and they're going to turn, and it takes a lot of will and intention and intervention to get it to turn in a different direction. And so if you are one of those leaders, the challenge is to find the context and the leadership ability and the mental bandwidth and the mental, you know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of that goes into it to be able to turn that machine in a slightly better direction. And to be able to lead it into a future that is slightly more sustainable, slightly more circular, slightly more inclusive than it would have just driven forward and, you know, and done otherwise.
And sometimes that takes courage. It takes
100%.
You know, it takes a willingness to step into the fire a little bit. I mean, I was just thinking of the Dylan Mulvaney situation with Bud Light, where, you know, in the end, it was a horrible situation. But the marketing people who were involved in that, I think they thought they were doing probably something that was good for their audience, that was a different take, that, you know, was supportive of a group of trans people who they supported the general acceptance of. And that in the end of the day, not only did she, well, she was canceled by a big group of people, Bud Light sales went down, those people were fired. So yeah. It's a really interesting values discussion of what kind of person you want to be.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, how do you live with yourself and what your why is?
Yeah. I mean, let's unpack just that example, because I think this is a perfect example of what we're talking about, because within the Bud Light, AB InBev, like, you know, corporation, you have multiple stakeholders, multiple different, you know, like, again, things that the machine desires.
Right.
So because of the decisions of one group of people that weren't, by the way, at the most senior level in the company, were actually more at the, this is my read of the situation, so people can tell me if I'm wrong, but we're more at the kind of brand, you know, director level, decided to go out on a limb with this partnership in terms of trying to live a specific set of values that were counter to its actual, the values of the market that it mostly served.
Right.
And you could make an argument that was a strategic mistake in terms of business leadership, but it was certainly a going out on the limb from a social impact, social justice standpoint, and saying, like, here's the kind of company we want to be. Again, there's so much levels of complexity there, because who was involved in that decision and the visibility that they had is, we don't know, right? Like, we don't know actually how far up it went, or if this was someone being rogue and, like, it got kind of rubber stamped without someone paying attention to it. Who knows? Like, that's where it's like, we can't just say Bud Light made a decision, because it wasn't, to your point, Bud Light is not a person.
Well, having grown up in the brand management world, I'm sure it went up to at least the VP of marketing. So.
Yeah, that's my thought. That's my thought as well, right? But even, think about that, like, the complexity of the cultural backlash to that being specific to the US, and Bud Light being this more global brand. Like, you have people in Canada, you have people, like, in other parts of the world that had nothing to do with that campaign and are being affected by that. And so you've also got these, like, specific cultural nuances from culture to culture and country to country that usually aren't very integrated to what's happening in the US. So I've seen brand campaigns in the UK, for example, get backlash that then people get asked about in the US when, and you know how corporate structure works. Like, those teams are lucky if they ever even talk to each other. So we've created this complexity that now, because we've flattened the rest of the globe, that complexity actually doesn't allow us to make decisions strategically and fast enough and move with the world in a way that we are constantly getting this backlash. And sometimes that backlash is very warranted, and sometimes it's just like, we're just not moving fast enough.
Yeah.
It's wild, honestly, if you step back and think about it. It can be overwhelming.
And it does really create a challenge for marketers who want to be at least with the trend, if not ahead of the trend, so that they can leverage that trend. I mean, I think when they were considering Dylan for that campaign, there was a lot more of a, it was a lot more of a, they saw more of a pro-trans, pro-acceptance mindset growing in the United States. So by the time it was executed, I think the world, the part of the America had
gone
and had developed an antipathy toward that. And they really
To my point about a backlash, like, that backlash has been growing, and it was a wave that maybe they just didn't see coming.
Yeah. 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 So as, when you think about, and I want to talk, I want to get into the fatherhood part, but when you think about individual contributors, I guess my mind, you know, with the benefit of age and not no longer being in corporate America, I can say this, but establishing your own personal values, how important that is, so that you know when you come upon these situations, what your line in the sand is going to be. It's one thing if you, you know, you're working for Barack Obama and he's the greatest man in the world and, you know, he can do no wrong almost. But there, most of us, at least in corporate America, in some sort of management or business role, do run up against ethical values-oriented decisions all the time. Yeah. And is there anything that you can say about that?
I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head, which is that we have to have these conversations before we need them. Yeah. And we don't. That's what it comes down to. It's like most of the time we've either not had conversations, especially if you're a big corporation, but even if you're a mid-market or smaller firm, you don't really have conversations about what do we believe in? What are our values? What are our principles? What do we, you know, to the level of complexity that actually helps us make day-to-day decisions. We have them at the top level, like, oh, we believe in inclusion. Great. So in this context, did it mean that we would include Dylan Mulvaney in this campaign? Do you know what I mean? Like,
right, yeah.
When you start breaking it down to be making operational decisions, those values become pretty shallow pretty quickly because the world is more complex than a few, you know, principles and values and mission statements on paper. So we don't actually have the kind of sophisticated breaking down of what do these things that we say we believe in actually mean in these different scenarios, and then have action plans for even when we have created a like safety net of what we believe and what we value in a sophisticated way, things are going to go through the holes because we can't anticipate every situation. So how are we going to mitigate that from a workflow perspective, from a decision-making perspective, when things come up that we didn't anticipate? So there's a lot of pre-work that we just don't want to stop and do because it's an opportunity cost. We could be spending our time elsewhere. And it's a you know what I mean? Like, we are trying to mitigate a crisis that hasn't happened yet and it doesn't feel urgent yet.
Yeah, the day is taken over by talks of distribution or cost of goods or whatever. There's not a lot of time where people are sitting down and saying, let's have a conversation of where our values are specifically for us. Like, you kind of know vaguely, you shouldn't steal from the company. You probably shouldn't lie, but you really don't know if your boss said, oh, today we're going to lie a little bit, how you'd react. So I want to flip this because I think it is really germane to the subject of fatherhood, because we're talking about about values and how important they are. How did writing the book affect the way you think about your role as a father? You've got three kids now. You only had one when we met, but you got older son in high school all the way down to eight.
Yeah.
Did the kids affect the way you thought about some of the things in the book, or did the book affect you the way you think about fatherhood?
So I would say yes. I mean, I would say that this book was really a culmination of, you know, at least 10 years of my career in terms of being reflective and things that I've learned and trying to bring those principles under one umbrella. And so how could I not talk about stories of, you know, trying to be a parent in corporate America, or stories of trying to, you know, consider my kids' future when I'm talking about how to make change? Like, so of course that created several self-reflective moments. And then there are stories in the book, one in particular that I'm thinking of right now, that's about how my work with my middle kid really helped reframe for me how we change our minds about things and how information is received. Like, the story, I'm going to butcher this, the story was about the way that they learned about photosynthesis, I believe, when they were in second grade, and how they like asked me questions and we were talking about, you know, all these kind of intricate scientific details, but actually all they wanted to know was like this one really basic thing. And, you know, I've heard many other people tell similar stories about like how you converse with children and how you like give them kind of age appropriate information. Mm-hmm. And usually what we do is kind of go way deeper than they were even asking for when they want to be like just super literal. Like, I just wanted to know why a plant is green. Why are you giving me like a lecture about photosynthesis? You know what I mean? Like, that's
exactly.
Kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I think I relate that story back to, you know, how I think about, you know, keeping persuasion really basic, and how when we are presented with counterfactual, you know, things to our core beliefs, we don't actually absorb them very often. So there's going back to your central point, like there's stories about my kids in there. Definitely like give shout outs to them at several points. And it's just when you're, you know, that's when your father, like, you're just so, this, could there be a role more suited to be worried about the future than being a parent? Yeah. Right. And the whole book is about how do we change how we change so the future can be a better one. So it's just, it's very personal. It's very self-reflective in terms of like how we do that individually, not just how we do that corporately.
Yeah. I love to think that a lot of dads are thinking that way in terms of not just creating a child or a legacy, but in some way teaching that child to be, at least have some sort of shared vision of a better world. I'd love to think that I created two better human beings than I am. I do this work and have been working with dads for 15 years, as you have at some point more actively, but I certainly didn't know what I was doing a lot of it. And a lot of it, yeah. A lot of what I'm thinking now and what I try to help dads do is try to create that framework of talking to their kids in a more intentional way. I know that word is overused by me as well as a lot of other people, but I think it does speak to what you're saying about like, how do you craft those conversations? So you actually do set aside time to develop them in a way that isn't just, I expect you to be a good person, but you're really developing those attitudes and those values along the way.
Yeah. Yeah. Where you're kind of starting from a vision of who you want them to be and working backward. I mean, I don't do that as much as I should. Like, I don't think any of us do. We're like, to a point, kind of absorbed by the day to day.
Yeah. Yeah.
But if we're going to make molding them into who we want them to be a daily practice, it also has to be, you know, somewhat of a daily focus, which is hard.
So did you use any kind of mantra or any kind of tradition in your family to help establish some of that?
I think our tradition, so I have, you know, individual mantras, but I think the one that we've had to repeat with our kids the most is just, it's very simple. It's just, we can do hard things. Like, it's literally just a, when we are running into frustration with it, if whether it's homework or whether it's social anxiety or whether it's, honestly, whether it's just doing chores or things that, you know, we don't actually want to do, we'll just repeat that. Like, we can do hard things, guys. Like, this is not, you know, mystify the idea that if something creates some kind of emotional barrier, that it is immediately like impossible to do. Like, there's a lot of emotional intelligence that goes into learning that kind of thing, mm-hmm. that we try to reinforce, and we try to have like honest conversations about our feelings and not shame people for having negative feelings. You know, like there's a lot of going into, honestly, like years of therapy that my wife and I have done trying to unpack that for ourselves and just try to set them up for more emotional success. And part of that is like creating some of that resiliency.
Yeah. I love that one. I'll add that in. I've heard of other people, like we sometimes refer to like team Banus Kim. My wife is Jasmine Kim, but you know, that kind of feeling like you're in it together. You have a family and we do hard things. I mean, that's just, if you reiterate these messages, and I think there's not enough emphasis put on the value of repeated messages to little brains, because
yeah.
they do grow up and say, you know, my dad always said we do hard things, and
right.
you know, I'm attacking it. And on the other side, if the message is always negative, that is, I mean, that's probably even worse on the scale. But I love that idea. We did not have a sort of a partial religious traditions in our house. Is there anything about that you need religious traditions, or do you think, or are there other traditions that can take the place of religious traditions in a world, in an America that's, you know, increasingly less religious or
yeah.
less traditions oriented?
I mean, I think it's important to have traditions and to have rituals that are comforting. Like, this is a thing our family does and we always do it this way. And kids need that kind of repetition and ritual for a sense of stability. I don't necessarily think that needs to come from religion. I wouldn't necessarily call ourselves a big religious household, but we've definitely been intentional, especially my wife. I give her a ton of credit for this, for just being intentional around holidays, especially, but like key moments and milestones throughout the year. Actually, I reference this in the book as well, because I do talk about the power of rituals for changing behavior in a corporate environment. And I actually pull it back to something that we do at the beginning and end of every summer, which is, I forget what she calls it. It's, I think it's called a summer kickoff or end of summer festivities. Like basically like the beginning of summer and the end of summer, we just make them really special, uh-huh. You know, just to try to, again, create some sense of ritual, which is really fun. It's like, we'll do a water balloon fight or we'll, you know, go to a Cubs game or we'll do something special to kind of mark the moment.
I love that. I'm sure they look forward to that every, I mean, they know that's coming and they look forward to it and they refer back to it. I'm sure.
Yeah.
That's really sweet.
We started burning homework at the end of the year too. like put it in the fire pit. My oldest especially enjoys that.
Yeah. So are there any lessons that you can impart that you've learned along the way? I mean, I'm sure we both learned a ton of things through doing, but are there any specific ones that you maybe didn't expect or would want to share with a younger dad?
Yeah, I mean, the one that I learned early on and have tried to implement and is really hard, is probably very hard. I don't think it's hard for me now, but it was definitely hard at the beginning, is just be quick to like acknowledge when you are not, when you need to apologize and your behavior wasn't up to your own standard.
Yeah.
It is a very powerful message to apologize to your kid because you lost your temper or you said something you weren't supposed to say, or, you know, like they internalize that stuff so much more than we know and we think. And to see them both model that we are not perfect and we are just human. And we also, you know, lose control of our emotions sometimes, and that's okay. And to like actively repair the relationship is, I think, incredibly powerful. And so I would add, that's the advice I would give to any, you know, to really lean into that and don't be afraid to like acknowledge mistakes.
That is really, that's really sweet because I've lost my temper. And I really try to avoid, I always try to really avoid yelling at the kids, but I have lost my temper. And quite often when it's happened, it has been something, you know, completely ridiculous. It wasn't for, you know, it wasn't something dangerous or sometime when yelling would be actually justified. And I have found that if you go back to them, you can erase the potential hurt. If you say that was wrong, I should not have raised, you know, whatever happened, what does not reach that level of anger, and you do not deserve to hear that from me. And it does make an impact. And I think that's a great piece of advice. How about, would you have a weekly challenge for our listeners for what they like, one thing that they could try to do to, you know, set an intentional activity with their kids or how they act toward their kids during the coming week?
Yeah. I mean, I, in the spirit of trying to create resiliency and emotionally intelligent kids, or at least emotionally healthy kids, if they can't be intelligent yet, you know, one thing that we've tried to do is really prioritize talking to our kids about how much we like their, so not about necessarily the outcome, but like, I really like when you make things. I really like when you draw. I really like when you are really like seeing this output, this like effort from you. Mm-hmm. And it makes me really happy. So it's not about like, the finished product is good. And it's definitely not about you are good.
Right.
Because there are lots of things we could discuss about that.
Right.
But it is about when you put in the effort. Again, we can do hard things. Like when you put in the effort, I really like seeing that. I think that's great. And I'm proud of you for that.
Yeah.
So that would be my challenge. Just like find literally anything your kid's doing, like helping with the food, drawing something, doing their homework, helping with chores around the house. I mean, it could be literally anything. And just acknowledge that. Say like, hey, I saw that and I really liked it.
That's a good one. It's deceptively simple. If you've ever tried to do this, you'll find it is a little bit of a challenge, is to appreciate the activity or the effort rather than the end results.
Because
that's just how we are. I don't know if that's a cultural thing or if we're just wired that way. But
we were born with that, right? Like I mean, that was what we grew up with.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, this has been a lot of fun. Again, the book is No Point B. I think you've got a podcast that also kind of is a company.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I started about 6 months ago. We've been going where we talk about the news of the week from a social impact perspective.
Oh, wow.
And try to analyze just, you know, the Bud Light decision is a great one. We spent weeks on that, just trying to unpack it and try to figure out like, what was the right decision here? How was this? How did they handle the backlash and all of that? The podcast is called Leadership, and it's kind of a fun play on like, how messy, you know, this can get and how hard it is to make some of these business decisions. So if you're interested, definitely give us a listen.
Yeah, I apologize. I did not realize that you had that podcast, or I would have.
No worries.
I'll sign up after we get off, because it's always a pleasure to hear your opinions on a lot of things. And I'm looking for some new sources of news.
Yeah, definitely give us a listen. I'd love to hear what you think.
Okay. Well, any last minute closing thoughts, either on the book or fatherhood?
Oh, man. One last quote thought. I don't know. It's the best job in the world and the hardest job in the world. And I'm honored to do it every day. And I try to, I think as someone who has spent an inordinate amount of time trying to focus on professional success, I definitely, like, speaking of daily practice, try to box that in for myself, and would encourage anyone else to do that. And my mantra for this decade, speaking of mantras, is more work to live, not live to work.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's a good thing to close on. Okay. This is Paul Bates of GreatDad.com. My guest again, Caleb Gardner, and his book, No Point B. I'll pitch that again for you. And we'll see you again next week. In the meantime, my course on gratitude is available, and it's usually $39. But if you go to GreatDad.com/gratitude, you can have it for $1 with the code podcast1. So again, until next time, take care.